Welcome to Woodshop Life Podcast, a bi-weekly podcast focused on the craft of woodworking. I'm Guy from Guy's Woodshop, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Hui Huynh.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. And Brian.
Top of the morning to you.
Top of the morning. This podcast is intended to answer questions from the woodworking community and give you some of our perspectives on how we get things done in our own shops. And we also have a Patreon account. Right now, we have one level, and we're simply asking for a small donation just to try to cover the cost of bringing you this podcast. So please go to patreon.com/woodshoplife. And we'd like to thank our newest patron for their pledge, Steve from Canada. Thanks, Steve. And we sincerely hope that you will give us your support. And stay tuned to the end of the show to hear about what we've got going on in our own shop. So let's get right into it. Hui, you've got the first question.
The first question is from Jeremiah. I've recently found the podcast and I'm loving going back and learning from each episode. I've noticed that a ton of time has been dedicated to doling out wisdom on different types of finishing techniques and products. I'm sure the best way to learn all of this is through experience, but do you have any resources to recommend budding woodworkers as a go-to guide? With the way my brain works, learning the origins of each finish, their makeups and how that brings about their use cases and strengths, weaknesses would go a long way for me to internalize all the various do's and don'ts. Do you have a resource you go to when considering applicable finishing materials on a new project? I don't have a go-to resource. I have probably two or three go-to finishes that I use, but I don't necessarily have a go-to resource. That being said, I did kind of do a little bit of a search on the different resources I think, or one resource in particular, I think might be very useful to you, Jeremiah. And that is Understanding Wood Finishing by Bob Flexner. It's a book. And it is not the type of book that you would expect to get some stories or interesting stories about Bob Flexner's time reviewing furniture and reviewing finishes. It's going to be very much like, hey, I'm interested in shellac finishes. Shellac finishes. This is the origin of shellac finishes. They come from the lac bug, blah, blah, blah. Here's how you would apply. This is the sort of pound cuttage that is typically used on this type of furniture. Here are some tips on how to apply that to make it look this way. It's very much going to be a reference book purely about wood finishes. And I think that would be a good source or resource for you to start with. But let's not, you know, go down all of the books. Well, let's not have me talk about all the books that Jeremiah could look into. What about you, Guy? Do you have anything, any tips, any go-to resources that you could recommend for Jeremiah?
Bob Flexner is awesome. There's another author who wrote, doesn't do the finishing anymore, but he makes guitars. But he wrote a couple of very good books for Taunton Press. His name is Jeff Jewett.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a couple books out that's very practical and explains a lot of different finishes. If you go to Amazon and do a search on his name, I think he's got two books. I'm not sure. I know I read one of them way back in the day. Mm-hmm. Might have been 20, 25 years ago. And again, very practical approach to using the finishes. I don't think there's a lot of origin stuff like Bob Flexner would do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's pretty good. And another good, you know, we've talked about this before. If you go to a website like Fine Woodworking or Wood Magazine,
yeah,
and join up there, you actually get access to all their back copies of articles. And there's a ton of stuff there. I highly recommend the Fine Woodworking one because it's got a lot of good stuff there. So, mm-hmm. Brian?
I was going to recommend the Flexner book as well.
Okay.
My dad has it and seems to really enjoy it. I am not a student of finishing, so I don't own any books on finishing or really I've never had the desire to dig into it like that. One other thing that I know has been helpful for my dad is he's explored different finishing methods and materials is General Finishes University. So General Finishes, the brand of finished product, make Armor Seal among all kinds of other finishes. They have a pretty excellent set of online resources, as well as I know he's spoken with product representatives from General Finishes when he's had questions applying finish to tabletop to a table he made for my brother, and seemed to be really, really pleased with the level of customer service he got there. So you've also got the option as you get into finishing something, Jeremiah, to potentially reach out to a manufacturer and troubleshoot issues or learn a little more from them as well.
Yeah, for sure. Well, awesome. I think that would do it for this question. Is there anything else, Guy or Brian, you want to add in terms of recommendations for him?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good stuff on YouTube on finishes. Not necessarily spraying finish, because nobody likes to videotape spraying finishes because it gets all over their cameras and stuff. But there's a lot of good. There's a lot of good videos on hand applying a lot of different finishes. So I recommend searching out some of those.
Would you say that your hand-applied finish is probably one of the first things that you learned how to do? Like, me as well.
Absolutely.
It requires the least amount of equipment. It's,
Actually, one of the finishes I used for a very long time is something I picked up in the Jeff Jewett book, which is the
a third
linseed oil,
naphtha,
polyurethane, and naphtha. That's where I got that from.
Right on.
All
right, we'll move on to the next question.
Brian.
All right, this question is from Ivan. And Ivan writes, "Hey guys, I have a kind of lengthy question. So new to woodworking, and I've been listening to your guys' podcast and really like it. Very helpful. I'm glad you find it helpful, Ivan. Question, is it better to have a good table saw blade over a good saw? And two, is it, so it's kind of a two-part. Number two, is it better to have a good table saw over a good Incra fence? Backstory, I have a Delta table saw I got free from a friend. Was wondering if it's worth spending the money or saving and eventually getting a better saw like a Powermatic. Maybe I get caught up in the details of tools and expect them to do the work for me, but I'm someone that likes to have the right tools for the job. Granted, as new as I am, it's hard to justify $10,000 to have all the right tools. Just wondering if I should focus more on making something than on the tools. Hope it all makes sense. Thanks for all the work you guys do." Ivan, so my recommendation is if it's the woodworking that's drawing you into the hobby or into the craft, then I would focus on building some stuff and learning to work with the tools you have. And you know, the function of a table saw or the function of a bandsaw doesn't change all that significantly from tool to tool, or from maker to maker, I should say. So learn with what you have, and it's okay to throw a new blade on there. I mean, a new blade is good to have from a safety standpoint as well as a quality standpoint. But if you've got a new blade and you've eliminated that variable and you're still getting questionable quality cuts, then you can start troubleshooting. Is it a blade alignment issue or a fence alignment issue? And kind of learn the tool and learn how to build and kind of do those at the same pace. And over time, if you decide that, you know, it's worth it to you to spend money on new equipment, then by all means do so. But if you're wondering if that is sufficient for building, it seems to me like it would be. The way I want to reframe this question for you is, how do you justify an upgrade to your tools? And give me an example of a time where you've, you know, had to weigh the pros and cons of keeping the tool you have and just working with it versus making a, you know, a spendy upgrade to something that'll still get the same job done.
So, I'll go ahead and go first. So one thing that he mentioned here is getting a new table saw blade. And I think right off the bat, excuse me, not new table saw blade, a good saw blade. I think right off the bat, he should have a good saw blade, regardless of whether or not he has the Delta or the Powermatic. And that's, it's irrelevant of brand, model, make, year, whatever. you should have a good table saw blade. You don't have to get a $200-$300 table saw blade, but you should try to get a good table saw blade that has a good amount of carbide on it that can be resharpened, that you can get a lot of life out of it. And I think that's what you're going to get out of a good table saw blade, other than a good quality cut, is longevity. So get something that you can get a little bit of longevity from. It will save you money in the long run. It just might be a few years. However, these saw blades, particularly ones with enough carbide on them to be resharpened, you can get almost a lifetime, if not a lifetime, out of them. I have often justified upgrading, say, a table saw fence or rip fence for the bandsaw, or maybe a fence or an attachment to the router table, simply by the fact that I know that I can justify it, knowing that if I do upgrade the main piece of hardware, I can still use that other upgrade for, say, said fence or a tall auxiliary fence or whatnot. The point is that I know that the accessory upgrade will improve the hardware upgrade, the main hardware upgrade, down the road if I decide to go that route. And I think in this case, it makes a lot of sense, because you would probably, particularly if you went the INCRA route, you would probably take that INCRA fence and integrate it some way into that Powermatic TAW that you might get down the road. Hopefully that makes sense. But that's how I justify it. Yeah. Guy?
I'm with you on the saw blade thing. Good saw blades, router bits, all that stuff is, to me, it's worth the price. Every time I see one of these cheap Chinese bits in a router at work, I cringe. It's like, why?
You know, yeah,
it's going to last, you know, 20 minutes in our shop. Yeah. The things get so much use. Now, buy good bits and blades, and you'll be happy in the future. As far as upgrading a table saw goes, I don't know if it's necessary, because he says he has a Delta table saw, but that's really not enough information. I mean, is it a job site saw? Is it a contractor saw? Is it a
Is it a 1990s Delta Unisaw?
I'd say keep it. Yeah. So the most important thing in a table saw, as far as the blade goes, is making sure the blade is parallel to the fence. So there's lots of videos on YouTube, and there's lots of information. There's lots of things you can buy to help calibrate that. That's something you really have to look at. And if that works good and the saw is fairly heavy and it doesn't tend to walk around or move a lot or shake when it operates, I'd say just keep the saw. The only reason I upgraded to the Powermatic is because Powermatic was sponsoring me at the time. Mm-hmm. I had a Steel City saw it was great. I loved it. But again, Powermatic made an offer to me to use it, and I said, "All right, I'm good with that." Actually, I approached them. I should mention that I wanted the Powermatic over the SawStop. Anyways, doesn't matter. But as far as justifying upgrades in the shop, there are some things that I use a lot that sometimes they don't have the features that I need to get the job done. Mm-hmm. So a good example of that is like my router table. My router table is one of my most used tools in the shop when I'm making a project. So I had, you know, substandard table or router tables throughout the years, and I finally built myself what I consider, you know, the ultimate router table. Yeah.
You clickbait.
Yeah, I know. It's horrible, isn't it? It was well worth it for me. You know, here's an example where I didn't really upgrade is my drill press. Actually, I went down. I went from a 17-inch floor standing to I don't even know what size it is. I think it's a 12.
Steel inch. City, right? Like a 12-inch or 13-inch?
It's like a 12-inch tabletop one. Because I use the drill press, but I don't really use the drill press a lot.
Yeah.
And so it made sense for me to actually downgrade. Mm-hmm. My bandsaw I use a lot. So again, right. That's why I went with a larger saw. There are things that if you use it a lot and you can justify it, do it. Brian, I think it's back. I think that was your question, wasn't it?
Yep.
Excuse me, folks. It's early here. It's 4 o'clock in the morning.
In California. No. Yeah. somewhere in the Pacific Ocean, it's four in the morning.
Yeah.
Feels like
guys, back to you, man. So, well, right. Not back to you. You got the first question for you.
All right. All right. So this comes from Brian, not that Brian, but Brian that wrote this. Hi, fellas. Love the podcast and all your great advice. He says, I recently glued up a freestanding liquor cabinet and was very nervous about it being square, especially since it was difficult to check for square, measuring corner to corner in the front and back with all the various clamps on it. I ended up making the back panel, which fits into the rabbets, which I knew was square, placed it in the back without any glue, and while the glue dried on the various joints through the tenons in the top and bottom shelves, mid shelves, sit in stopped dados. The idea was that if the square back panel fit correctly, it would help pull the whole cabinet into square. Mm-hmm. What do y'all think? Does this method make sense? Any other suggestions on how to check or ensure square with freestanding cabinets of a decent size? Thanks, Brian. That is a very, very good way to do it. There is nothing wrong with that. I've done that many times, put the backs in or just actually used spacers.
Yeah.
And put them in special places so I can make sure that, you know, the things are sitting where they need to be and things don't go out of square. You know, we always talk about making a project and then doing a dry fit, a dry clamp. That's fine. However,
sometimes you can't do that.
A, you can't do it. But B, after you put glue on things, everything changes. Parts start sliding around. Parts don't fit. All kinds of weird things can happen. Once you put glue on it, it's a different thing. Mm-hmm. So a big cabinet like that, I always like to do a pre-clamp on it just to get my clamping solution. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily that this is the way it's going to be clamped as square, but just so I know where to put the clamp so I can get them on quickly. Mm-hmm. But I have used things like he's talking about the putting the back in. Hui, what do you do to make sure a large cabinet like that is, let's say, square?
So I'm really, really happy Brian asked this question. I'm really happy that you brought up this question because I've got a large China. And look at this. So he's got 46 inches tall, 26 inches wide, 16 inches deep is this freestanding cabinet, right? Mm-hmm. Man, having that back, I'm really happy you reassured that doing it this method will work and is a good solution, because I've got this gigantic China cabinet and I've got it's a dovetailed case, right? Big giant case. It's going to be about 6 feet tall, you know, 46 inches wide. And I'm thinking to myself, how am I going to get this thing square? You know, I can't put a clamp across. I don't have a big enough pipe, right? I could go and get one, but let me use this cabinet back and I'll clamp up the cabinet back, and the cabinet back is going to be frame and panel. Not shiplap. What do you call it? Tongue and groove panel, right? Multiple panels, but the outside frame is what's going to be glued together. So I need to make sure that outside frame is completely square. And then as I'm assembling the case, I'll put the back against the rabbets to sort of keep it and lock it into place the best I can. So Guy, that sounds like a good strategy to you. And am I correct in that?
Yeah.
All right. Then I'm going to do it. I'm going to do that. All right. Awesome.
I do the exact same thing. I mean, anytime I've got a cabinet, really of any size, I'm using that back panel, making sure that is square. And that's important, is to make sure that's square. Mm-hmm. which it sounds like our listener, Brian, who is not me for the record.
Brian.
Well, when I get to my next question, it's actually one I've submitted. So I think it's important to clarify on this one. Yeah, it is to do that and to know that that's going to help pull everything square. Now, so for my application, Brian, I'm almost always doing plywood cabinets. And you know, even with high grade plywood, really hard to make sure that some of those longer pieces stay flat. So I really rely on a square cabinet back to kind of pull everything square so that I don't have these sides that are bowing in, you know, just based on the, you know, a little bit of that more flexible or flimsy nature of the plywood over a solid wood, over a long, narrow run.
Right. So, middle sag in the middle of a cabinet, yeah. Right?
Yeah. Well, even sometimes like on the side, you know, on the side.
On the sides. Yeah.
I've got some riffs on white oak plywood, which would be the topic of my next question. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, to my dismay, the thing, you know, you look down the side of it, you flip it up on its side, and the thing is, you know, it's like the shape of a C. Yeah. So yeah. on its own, but when you put, you know, but when you use it, you know, as a side of a cabinet and top and bottom of a cabinet, you can square that with a square back panel rabbeted in. So it ends up working out.
Another way to do it, especially if you've got very, like I've glued up some, I know this is maybe a little bit out of left field, but I've glued up some very large tables, you know, 12, 14 foot long table bases.
Yeah.
And we've got some very long clamps, believe it or not. We have like some 10 and 12 footers, but when you're doing some of this, it's almost impossible to get them on there and get it done. So clamping squares, you know, you can buy some from like Woodpeckers, or you can make some like I did. Mm-hmm. And they're just squares that have holes in them, or they're angles, and you can just clamp it in that one area to mm-hmm. keep that one thing square. Because what Brian's talking about is very prevalent, especially in cabinetry work. When you're working with plywood and it's bowing on the sides, it's very hard to get a corner-to-corner measurement,
right?
Because those sides are bowed. Worry about getting
the joint square.
The joint square. Yep. And those clamping squares do work. They're a little fiddly to put on, but they do work.
Yes. So, yeah, I agree.
I've used those quite a bit, especially in larger pieces.
Yeah,
used them. And a lot of companies have started to, particularly like Rockler and Woodcraft, they have those clamping squares now that have the little holes in there so that you can hook the clamp in. Whereas I think the Woodpeckers ones, at least the older ones, they're just flat. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're good.
I actually made some at work for table aprons that have all kinds of little cutouts in for the legs and everything else. So, they work well. So,
cool. Yeah. And I bought the Woodpeckers, the clamping squares plus and CSP clamps, which are just the L shape anodized aluminum with, you know, they've got a half dozen holes in both sections of the L. And then you put those little clamps in there. And those work great. And I use, to your point, Guy, use those, you know, at the glue joint to maintain square there.
Okay. All right. Have to add on to this little information. Make sure the joint is square. Don't worry so much about the walls. The walls will be square based on the cabinet back. Okay.
You hope.
Yeah. The best you can, right? Yeah. All right, cool.
All right.
I will use the clamping squares in my glue.
Hui, back to you.
Yeah, so this question is from Joe R. Love the show. I appreciate you guys giving it the time it takes to make this happen. My question is about a solid walnut table that I built for my eat-in kitchen. The material was 30-year-old plus air-dried walnut milled down to the thickness of about 15/16 for the tabletop. Each board is 6 to 8 inches in width and makes up 32 inches wide tabletop by 5 foot long and change in length. I used the dominoes for alignment, tight bond 2 for the glue. The tabletop is inspired by Nakashima and is connected to the tabletop using buttons and screws connected to the two rails at top each of the splayed legs. I did not add any type of support down the center, nor any type of skirting or an apron, so there's about 4 feet in between the table legs of unsupported tabletop. I've been using this table for a few months now, and every once in a while, I'll place my Veritas straight edge on it and check. It hasn't seemed to move at all in any direction, but yet I still think about this multiple times a week. What are your thoughts on this? Will this eventually sag in the middle without a continuous support running the center of the table? Yes and no. Does wood move?
Well, that's helpful.
Will it sag because it's unsupported? Probably. Will your specific table not sag because it's unsupported? Probably. Well, it's been a few months, right? So I don't know. A few months. Let's see here. What would you classify as a few months? 3 to 4. So 3 to 4 months. That's been basically a season from, say, fall to winter. Will it sag? I don't know. Hasn't sagged yet. Maybe it won't. Maybe it will. But the point is that I think at 15 16ths, I would probably bet that eventually you're going to get a little bit of not necessarily cupping, because it sounds like he's supporting it width-wise. Lengthwise, you may get a bow eventually there. 15 16ths is not super thick, although it's not weak by any means. But yeah, I think you will eventually get a little bit of sag. 4 feet, that's not, you know, if it was 2 feet, maybe 2.5 feet, I don't know. 4 feet, that's a good span. I've had plywood cup along that's been cantilevered on either along the width of the 4 foot wide plywood board. I've had it bow, and that's, well, it's not 15/16. It's also not solid hardwood, but I have had plywood bow when it's supported, you know, 4 feet apart. What are your thoughts, Guy? Since you do a lot of long tabletops.
Well, I don't think he's going to have an issue.
Okay.
That's not a long enough span, mm-hmm. I think, to really worry about it. And if you are worried about it, mm-hmm. you can put a support right down the middle of it underneath, mm-hmm. and just put a board edge side up so it's a little bit stiffer.
Yeah.
And put it on there that way. That's one way to do it. Go ahead, Brian.
Can I interrupt and ask a clarifying question on that?
Yeah.
Well, since I've already started interrupting, I'm going to go ahead and ask a clarifying question. When you put that board on its edge, running down the length of the table like that, uh-huh. mm-hmm. given that the table is only 15/16 thick, would you glue the board
no.
to it, or would you simply screw it, knowing that there isn't that much material for the screw to grab into before going 15, through the top of the table?
15/16 is a lot of material.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's almost an inch.
Yeah. I'm used to working with our inch and a half thick tables.
Yeah. The thing that you really have to, using legs on a table without aprons going along its length, I think in this situation has been solved because the legs are splayed. If the legs weren't splayed and those legs were straight up and down and there was no long apron connecting the two of them across its length, that whole table would shift along its length.
Huh. Okay.
You mean like rack?
Like rack. Exactly.
It would rack.
Would rack along its length because there's nothing keeping those two legs or those four legs or the two sets of legs parallel with each other. Splaying them out solves that problem. So that's not going to be an issue. This is things that we deal with all the time. Mm. And they have to be done a certain way. But our rule of thumb on tabletops, because we do supports, we actually take a 2-inch tube steel mm-hmm. with welded tabs on it and screw it up underneath the table to keep them flat. When you walk in our showroom at work, this drives me nuts. Brian knows about this. It drives me nuts. We have this 12-foot-long walnut table that's 4 feet wide. And every time I walk from my desk into the showroom, I see it. It's sunk in the middle at least a quarter of an inch.
Oh, really?
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Like a bow or a cup?
It's sagged in the middle.
It's a bow. It's,
but we don't do it that way anymore. So this was an old, very old table.
Right.
What we do now is anything that has over 8 feet or over between the legs, we're putting steel support bars underneath.
Lengthwise.
Lengthwise to keep it from sagging.
Gotcha. Right. Because no apron. Got it. Yeah. Got it.
And the way we attach our legs when they're straight up and down, let's say, we have these large steel plates that we'll fix the legs to give us some lateral support.
Right.
They don't flex at the tabletop.
Yeah, it's about a 5 or 6 inch wide plate.
It depends on what we're doing, but it's typically a 5 inch plate. It depends on the leg. Sometimes legs are 3 inches wide, where I can put a 5 inch plate, we're gonna take like a 6 inch.
So you guys used to use that's I guess it's called C channel, whatever it's called, the steel that you put underneath. You used to do that widthwise.
Yeah, we don't do that anymore.
Yeah, we don't do that anymore because it doesn't work.
Gotcha.
It just doesn't work. It's if the table's going to bow, it's going to bow. It's going to take that piece of steel right with it. That's what we found. If a table, like I said, we're not going to get into that discussion. But anyways, as far as bowing, I don't think he's going to have a problem over 4 feet. My concern with that would be the legs being stiff, but splaying out solves that problem. So
yeah.
Cool.
Now Joe had also, he had also mentioned that he used dominoes for alignment and tight bond 2 for the glue, which is good information. My take is that won't have any bearing on whether or not the table is going to sag in the middle. No. Do you guys agree?
Oh yeah.
So that won't have any bearing on that.
That's
so
not going to matter. No.
Yeah.
Don't put
when I would listen to the pod as a, just a listener, sometimes you hear things like that and you're like, oh, okay, maybe that actually makes a difference. Yeah. I want to address the fact that, you know, to all the listeners that the glue and the fact that dominoes are used in the tabletop for alignment won't actually have any impact whatsoever on, whether or not that table end up sagging in the middle. So,
well, all right. As my dogs are barking in the background, we'll move on to the next question, Brian.
Okay. All right. So we'll talk about it at the end of the podcast. We are in need of additional questions. And therefore I have taken the liberty to add one that I think hopefully a lot of people benefit from. I know I will. And I'm making a mantle for my living room out of Rifts on White Oak plywood. It's 74 inches long, doing it with miter fold design. So all the joints are mitered together, so you don't see any transitions in the boards. My wife wants it to basically look the same way it does unfinished, but I, of course, say, hey, we need to apply finish to this. So I don't know how to do that or if it's even possible. You see, it seems like all the rage anymore. You see white oak everywhere and it looks as it looks very natural. It's not golden and yellowed. And amber. It's almost got a whitish hue to it. So I've tested with water-based poly using the Minwax polyacrylic. But it still kind of ambers it up or yellows it up a little bit. So, for me and for probably all the other, guys and gals listening that are striving for that really natural looking white oak finish, any suggestions on how to go about accomplishing that? Can it even be done?
Wait.
Yeah. Sorry. I guess I don't have, since it's my question, but it's my question that I'm supposed to be answering.
Sorry.
Since I'm the one actually asking the question.
Yeah, you're asking. You're asking us. I'm like, are you going to answer that?
Yeah, curveball.
Duh. You could apply a gel stain to that white oak to prevent it from ambering like white oak? Yeah, is that a bad idea? I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, he's looking for a water white finish. So there's no.
See, that's what I'm wondering. So I'm wondering why this water based poly is giving you a bit of golden. Really?
I mean, like, so if I were to wipe it down with denatured alcohol, like I wiped it down after I finished sanding, and applying, you know, anything that's wet to it is going to darken the wood. So that's the effect I'm talking about. It's darkening it off of kind of that.
After it's dried, really?
Well, no. Obviously, the denatured alcohol is a temporary flash of
darkening, gotcha.
And then it returns to its original. But with the water-based poly that I've applied to a test piece, it of course, you know, goes darker as you put it on. But even after it's dried, it's, you know, noticeably still darker than what it looked like originally.
Dude, I don't know. What kind of... It's not one of the oil modified, is it?
No, it's just a basic Minwax polycrylic, the flat, ultra flat.
Wow, I don't know. I don't know why it would.
Should that, in theory, upon drying, return it to the original color of the wood?
Oh yeah, I mean, it might. Obviously, the sheen might change based on what kind of sheen you're using, but. I've never had, when I've applied water-based poly on some oak, it comes out water white. So like whatever that color is on the oak, it is that color.
It returns to it once it's dried.
Right. Hmm. So, which makes me wonder why that's happening. I've not had a significant color change, darkness change in using water-based poly. In fact, actually, that typically ends up being one of the things I dislike about using water-based poly is that it doesn't give it that golden, that deeper oiled look, right?
Sure.
Yeah. So that's kind of interesting that's happening. I don't know what to say about
just
that.
Just so everybody understands exactly what we're talking about, when you use an oil-based finish like a polyurethane, whether it's a wipe-on poly or whatever, and you put it on the wood, it adds a little bit of amber color to the wood. And people generally like that because it adds depth and everything else. What Brian is talking about is using a water white finish. In other words, it's just like a clear finish. It doesn't give any amber tones at all to the wood. Mm-hmm. And I think... honestly, using something like polycrylic is your best bet.
Okay.
Is it going to look exactly like it does before you put the finish on? Of course not. I think your expectations are...
maybe inflated.
a little bit.
And that's kind of what I'm asking. Is it even realistic?
It's a little bit skewed. Yeah, it's going to be different. It's going to be different. It's not going to look exactly the same. But it's not going to give it that amber tone. Sure. So there you go.
Yeah. I know one thing I've done in the past, and I don't want to do it on this mantle because of just how prominent it is in our house, is I've taken a Minwax white stain. They've got just a regular old white oil-based wiping stain.
Yeah,
and I have very, very lightly applied that and immediately tried to rub off as much of it as I could. And it almost whitewashed the wood in a way.
It's going to do that.
And it'll kind of fill the pores white.
You don't like that?
But there are some, it's tricky. Yeah. It's tricky to control. And I've had it go poorly once. And at this point on this mantle, I really don't want to run the risk of it having to scrap it and start over. So
a couple things there with that stain. So I know exactly what you're talking about. I've used it. Something that's helped me, two things, possibly a pre-stain conditioner, which is basically going to be some type of surfactant, right? Secondly, possibly before applying that water white. Again, if you're experimenting, not the water white, but the white stain.
Yeah.
Would be actually to go to a little higher grit. Mm. And that may retard the amount of absorption that you're getting into the pores of the wood.
Gotcha.
Just an experiment, right? Yeah. So maybe go to a 320 or something, or 220 or 320 when you're applying the stain. Typically, yeah. I think for my stains, I'm either somewhere between 120 grit and 180 grit that I'll apply the stain.
Yeah.
And then kind of lightly sand afterwards. Yeah. In this case, you might want to maybe go to a higher grit, see if you can get reduction in absorption so that it's not so drastic of a color change.
Another thing you can do also, and I've done this before, is use a water-based pore filler.
Mm.
That helps quite a bit.
Do you have a particular product recommendation there?
Yeah, I think it's Aqualac. I think it's what it's called.
Aqua.
It's Aqua something. That's what I've used. Just any water-based pore filler. It doesn't really matter. Grain filler. And you put it on there and don't sand it completely out, but it'll actually coat the surface a little bit, and it won't allow any color change at that point.
Aqua coat. Yeah.
You try that. That will also work.
Good tips.
Good. Helpful. Good, well, I know how popular that look is, and I know there are a lot of people trying to capture that.
That's people actually want. I'm not familiar with it. So that's a thing that's being purveyed on HGTV and their shows. Everything is white oak now. That's causing a lot of problems in the industry.
Right, but then it's filled with that white stain.
Yeah,
right?
And I've never seen that, so I don't watch any of that crap, so I don't know what that even looks like.
Right.
And
right.
Luckily, my wife hasn't asked for it yet, so
you don't have to learn about it.
Yeah, I don't have to learn about it yet.
Yeah.
So wonderful. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem, man.
All right, I think this is the last question for me.
It's the last question to you, man.
All right, this comes from Liam from Indianapolis. It says, "Hey, gents, thanks so much for the great content." Well, you're welcome. It says, "You have discussed spraying equipment setup in the past, but I was hoping you'd describe your spray booth setup. Obviously, Brian's exempt from this question since he doesn't apply finish." Boo. "How do you guys spray volatile finishes in the winter in your garage? Do you have a spray booth-like setup? Do you openly spray in your garage workshops? How do you vent potentially dangerous fumes? Any details you can provide would be appreciated, as I would like to do more spraying of shellac, and I like wipe-on poly, both of which are challenges in wintertime when you can't work outside." So what I use when I spray shellac in the shop, I just spray it. I don't cover anything up. I don't do anything. I just set it where I'm going to do it. And I use very, very low pressure, very small pattern, and I just spray it. And I'm not worried about it. I wear a respirator. If it's summertime, I may open up a door. But other than that, I don't really worry about it. All that stuff that tends to get on anything can easily just be wiped off because it's dry by the time it gets there. It just falls down as dust. Mm-hmm. If I'm doing something volatile, like I just sprayed these cabinets I did for my laundry room with a pigmented conversion varnish, and it was dark colored. It got everywhere. The only thing I could really do, because it was, you know, like 10 degrees below zero outside, it felt like anyways, I couldn't really open up a door. I did crack it just a little bit on both the man door and my garage door, just, I mean, like 2 inches, just so I could get some cross ventilation. But I put up a screen made, you know, one of those big canvas tarps you get at the home stores. And I actually clip it on with spring clamps to my rail, the garage door rail above. Yeah. just to like separate off that side of the shop from the other side of the shop. But I don't cover my machines or I don't do anything. Mm-hmm. And I sprayed it. And this stuff got everywhere. This dark green, or the, I should say this medium tone green dust just everywhere. But when I got done, all I did was just dust.
Yeah.
And it all just came away. So I don't worry about that. I don't spray. I've sprayed lacquer a couple times in my garage and I'll never do it again because it stinks up the whole house. Yeah. That's why I mainly use the water-based finishes. Yeah. Because it doesn't stink anything up.
I totally did not believe you, Guy. When I remember when I was doing these chairs and dining table for a client, chairs and dining table for a client, you had told me, how are you going to spray them? He's like, oh, I'm going to use a conversion varnish. And you're like, water base? I was like, no, the lacquer based, you know, whatever conversion varnish. And he's like, okay, we'll see how that goes. Well, it went fine. Other than the fact that everybody in my house, every time they walked out in the garage, are like, are you getting high out here? Like, it's so, so, so stinky. Yeah. And for that reason, I will not use it ever again.
Yeah.
It's too much.
And I've got the mechanicals in my shop. So my, you know,
furnace
and the blower and all that stuff, it's in the garage, man. It gets all over the house. Well, the thing is I'm the one that cleans the house. So my wife didn't really complain too much.
Yeah.
But it got everywhere, man. This light green stuff everywhere.
The water-based stuff does not have nearly the same stench.
Oh, no, it doesn't have smell. Any stench.
No, none at all. But I won't do it. If I've got to deal with the... Oh, I did want to add one thing. And I talked with... Because I was talking about spraying shellac. And I had called... they sell Fuji. They sell Apollo. I can't remember. Paint Sprayers Plus. Anyway, I know the guy from there. And I talked to him and I was telling him about my setup. And he says, hey, if you're using shellac, denatured alcohol is technically a fuel. So you might just want to be careful with where you set your turbine. Don't set it like, you know, in an area where you're just
basically got a flamethrower in your hands.
Right. Like you don't want to like have it really close to where the spray nozzle is going to be. Put it in a little bit. But there's always plenty of hose. So I didn't realize that. It's like, yeah, just if you're spraying shellac, don't put the turbine really close to where you're spraying. Yeah. You know, just have it a little further away so that the flame in there does not ignite any of the denatured alcohol that's being shot out of your gun.
Yeah, and if you're using shellac, I mean, really, it's when I'm using like a pound and a half cut, it flows. It's, you know, it flows like, you know, almost like it has no finish, just like it's straight alcohol. Mm-hmm. And it just flows out of there. You turn your power way down on the turbine and it's just, it's not beautiful. A big deal.
Yeah.
It's not a big deal.
I can't wait. Going to be doing that pretty soon. Anyway,
Brian, do you have any tips at all? No.
Nope.
Yeah, that huge spray system that you have there at.
Listen, my reputation. Liam's picked up on it. He goes, I know Brian won't have much for this. So,
man, we got to get you like a little Urlax or something so you can spray shellac and you know on your furniture pieces.
I mean, listen, if somebody wants to send me a free spray gun, I'm happy to test it out and tell you how poorly it went.
I heard the Urlax is actually pretty good.
It is. I used to have one
for shellacs.
I have no doubt.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I've got a large family staying with us, and by large family, I mean it's my mom and my sister, who are Vietnamese and very loud.
You just said they're large. That's not very nice, Wee.
All right. Large family.
Oh, large.
No, it's as in it's just two people.
All right. So what do you got going on in the shop, Brian? Anything?
Well, I'm making a Rifts on White Oak mantle.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. With a mitre fold, might I add?
Yeah, yes. Wait, yeah, which that maybe if nobody submits any questions, which we do need questions, people, then I've got a whole other topic for next podcast on cutting mitres on the table saw. But
you might just add it just anyway.
So. Yeah. No, I've got that going and wrapped up a big client project about a week and a half ago. So real pleased with that and a little bit of freedom in the shop ahead of me. So probably do a little cleanup, little equipment maintenance and yeah, try to get geared up for maybe some nightstands for our bedroom. We'll see. Undecided at this point. What about you, Wee?
Man, I'm a little bit upset about this last time I've been using transient dye with denatured alcohol. You know, I sanded everything down to about 150 and I applied it. I was like, man, it really raised the grain a lot more than I would have liked. I was just kind of surprised. So I ended up going over it with 220 a lot harder than I wanted to. So it doesn't, it still has some colorant into it, but I'm going to have to apply another coat of trans tin on it. It lightened it way too much after I sanded with 220. So I'll apply one more time. And then I think what I'll do is if there's any grain raising after this, the second application, I'm probably going to use a steel wool pad and just knock the edges down and call it good. But that's what I've been doing. A lot of sanding, but just a lot of mixing of shellac. So I'm testing out two different types of shellac. I'm going to use a platina, so just straight clear, and then also a ruby because the original piece that I'm trying to model had a lot of red tones in it. So I'm going to try this ruby and see how that goes. And I'm going to have three test pieces.
This pure is cherry, platina. Right?
This is walnut.
Walnut. Okay. I'm sorry.
Walnut. So this is, so I've got three test pieces. I've got pure platina. So four coats of platina. Then I'm going to do, another, test sample will be two coats of platina or excuse me, two coats of ruby with two coats of platina over top. And then the third sample will be four coats of just pure ruby color, shellac and see how that looks. See which ones the client likes the best, and then I'll start applying shellac to everything. But that's what I got going on. How about you, Guy? What do you got, man?
Just the usual stuff. Nothing.
Household chores.
Yeah. Actually, I've got some stuff still going on in the shop for things around the house. But at work, they asked me to... We got a little backed up and we sell these Indiana shaped cutting boards and we got a little backed up at work and they just couldn't get them done in time. So they asked me to cut them on the CNC and the thing is there's 120 of them. So, and it's actually pretty easy. I got the pass and everything for the CNC done in probably about a half an hour. And yeah. I got on the machine. It just takes like 8.5 minutes to cut out two of them out of the blanks they gave me. So I got to do it 60 times. You just do the math. It's very time involved more than anything else.
It's 8.5 minutes per blank on the CNC?
And I'm getting two per cut.
Oh,
so I can cut two out of the blanks they gave me. It takes 8.5 minutes to cut two cutting boards, which is really quick.
It is. That's not,
because the way we were doing it, the way we were doing it at work is we were taking a bandsaw and cutting them out rough. And then we had a pattern that gets screwed to it. And then we used the router table with the bit. Since there's so many little contours and there's a lot of end grain. Yeah. There's only a couple guys in our shop that are experienced enough to do that.
Right.
And they're very, very backed up and busy, and it just takes too much time. So we decided to just cut them on the CNC.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So it's going to work out in the best for us, I think.
Is the CNC not faster than the bandsaw?
Oh, yeah, definitely, right?
Yeah, okay. I was about to say, I was like, man, those guys are fast if they're doing it faster.
No. It takes a lot of time, is what I'm saying. Yeah. It takes a lot of time, is what I'm saying. So this way, it's going to get them done quick, and it's going to be much more efficient as far as the cost goes.
Yeah, for sure.
So
cool.
That's what I got going on. My shop's all covered with cutting boards right now in the shape of Indiana.
Look at that. Fine furniture maker.
Yeah. So I think that's going to do it for the show. And would like to thank everyone who left us a 5-star review on iTunes. It really does help us in the search rankings. And of course, we truly appreciate the support and feedback. So please remember, this podcast is here to answer questions from the work community. So as Brian said, if you have questions and you'd like them answered, you can send them through the podcast contact page at woodshoplifepodcast.com or DM us through Instagram at woodshoplife. And I can be found at Guy's Shop on YouTube and Guy's Wood Shop just about everywhere else. What about you, Hui?
AlabamaWoodworker.com. All the links to my socials are on my website. And Brian?
You won't find me on the traditional social medias, but I'll talk to you guys in 2 weeks on the pod.
All right.
All right. And we'll talk to you guys later.
Talk to you later.
See you later.